SBS Radio.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit is unumstossbar.
Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. He's fired!
Au nom du peuple français!
Wir schaffen das.
Make our planet great again.
Don't worry, be happy.
I will kill you if you destroy my country.
Better is always possible.
I ain't spending any time on it.
Hello, I'm Brett Mason in the gallery for SBS World News. Having survived another long week of Senate estimates, this weekend we're turning our attention to Washington. Our guest is Pat Kanaan, a man who says he grew up inside the White House, working as the Deputy Director of Messaging for the former US President Barack Obama.
The one issue that sort of frustrated and flummoxed us the most I think was this issue of gun violence in America. And that was something that it was shocking to me that even us sitting in the White House, we couldn't get anybody to act.
We'll hear more from Pat in a moment, but first here's our senior political reporter Maria Zivic with her take on the week that was.
Thanks, Brett. Former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce has landed himself firmly back in the headlines this week. This time it was his decision, along with new partner Vicky Campion, to accept a reported $150,000 fee in exchange for this tell-all TV interview, which airs this weekend on Channel 7's Sunday Night programme.
Vicky Campion comes clean.
You can't help who you fall in love with.
The people who tried to stop this baby being born.
Political pressure. They said if you don't, they're going to come after you.
They did.
The reported six-figure payment is unprecedented, given Mr. Joyce is still a sitting MP. The money will reportedly go into a trust fund for his six-week-old baby. Mr. Joyce claims he's tried to keep his private life private, but has given in because of intense media attention.
We tried for privacy, and the last fortnight we've had drones over our house, we've had paparazzi waiting for us outside Armidale Airport, we've had people following us to Urala. We tried just burning this out, and that didn't work.
He's taken 4 weeks personal leave while his colleagues are left fielding questions about his political judgment. It sparked this rebuke from Revenue Minister Kelly O'Dwyer.
Would you like to see him not do that interview?
Well, look, ultimately it's a matter for him and his judgment. I personally wouldn't do it. I don't think it's right, and I think most Australians are pretty disgusted by it.
Despite having a spring in its step more recently, the government has had its agenda overshadowed this week, and not just by Barnaby Joyce. Jobs Minister Michaelia Cash has been issued a subpoena by the federal court over a case relating to police raids on union officers late last year. She's instructed her lawyers to fight it.
With all due respect, I am absolutely not covering up. I am standing here at this point in time. How many journos are here? 15, 20 of you. I'm on national television as we speak. I am absolutely making myself available.
Health Minister Greg Hunt's also been in the spotlight for swearing at a 71-year-old grandmother during a meeting 6 months ago. The Mayor of Katherine in the Northern Territory, Faye Miller, was lobbying for her home region when she says the minister got abusive. She's accused him of misogyny.
He turned his chair to me and went towards me and said, you need to effing get over it. You need to effing make Senator Scullin your best friend.
The incident forced both a written and public apology from Minister Hunt this week.
I used strong language. I have apologised to the Mayor of Katherine. I should have apologised earlier. My fault and my responsibility.
The other side of the chamber hasn't been without its own issues. The latest news poll shows while Labor remains in front, two-party preferred, the personal popularity of its leader continues to decline. The poll also shows Bill Shorten's been overtaken as preferred Labor leader by colleague Anthony Albanese.
I think you would all agree that I've made a practice of not commenting on the polls when they're good, bad or indifferent. I haven't made a practice of focusing on polls.
The Coalition maintains its focus is to pass its corporate tax cuts in full, and it's now one vote closer. One Nation's Brian Burston's broken party ranks to offer his support, much to the delight of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull.
We're committed to doing everything we can to secure the votes of the senators to pass our budget measures. We are determined. We're determined to deliver on our commitment to the Australian people to deliver jobs and growth.
His government has another two sitting weeks to seal the deal before Parliament rises for a lengthy winter break.
Thanks, Maria. All eyes remain on Washington and the White House. Will US President Donald Trump actually hold that historic Singapore summit with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un? On a recent trip to London with our Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, I stumbled across a book at London's Heathrow Airport that immediately grabbed my attention. Its title, West Winging It, the story of a young student from Miami who accidentally finds himself sitting at a desk just a few metres down the corridor from the Oval Office. So, as you do, I sent the author a tweet and said, "Hey Pat, would you like to come on my podcast?" Thankfully, he didn't report me to Twitter and have me immediately blocked, and agreed to answer some questions about his 6 years working for Barack Obama. I began by asking him how on earth he ended up at the White House.
It was a lot of luck. Basically, I was down at school in Florida, University of Miami, and I was a senior and I had no clue what I wanted to do with my life. And my roommate, Chris, actually, is the one who turned to me and said, "You know, you like Obama. You've been writing opinion pieces about him. Why don't you apply for an internship at the White House?" And this was at the beginning of the administration. And I was sort of kind of ignorant at the time. And I actually thought that White House internships had gone away after the Clinton fiasco. But apparently they were still a thing. And so I applied online, sort of like you would apply to a university. And I initially didn't get it. And then I took it a little more seriously and applied again right away. And I started as an intern towards the beginning of the administration. And somehow they let me stay until the very end. I sort of kept failing up.
We all know that Barack Obama had a very tight team of advisors around him that had been with him since the start of his campaign in Chicago. What was it like for you coming into that very tight clique in Washington?
Well, it's a great question. And it's one of the reasons that I really wanted to write my book, West Winging It, because it's true. I came in to this White House as a total outsider, having never really worked in politics before. And more importantly, I got to know the president in the same way, you know, you and the rest of the world did, as this sort of remarkable figure who turned into the most famous man in the world. And then suddenly, through this strange turn of events, I found myself sitting at this rinky desk that was 30 feet away from his Oval Office. And it was a remarkable experience to sort of go from total outsider to sort of consummate insider in some ways. And it was something that I never got used to. I sort of had to pinch myself every single day I walked into the White House until the very last day. It was sort of after 6 years or more working there, it felt like it had almost been a dream. It was definitely a blur. But that was sort of my unique way into the White House was I wasn't involved in his campaign. So the first couple times I got to work with him, it was like working with this hero who I'd only ever seen on TV or heard on the radio. So it was really interesting.
We'll talk about your last day in a moment. Let's now focus on your first day. You said you had a few pretty embarrassing experiences.
Yeah, my first day was, let's just say I had a pretty inauspicious start to my time at the White House. First of all, my parents walked me to my first day at the White House, which is not the way you want to start your first day. It's a little bit embarrassing. It's not kindergarten after all. But so anyway, after they walked me to the first day, I remember vividly I was sitting in my office surrounded by these White House staffers, these real live White House staffers who I just assumed were just, you know, total geniuses and incredibly impressive people. And the truth is many of them were. But I was just fiddling with my computer and couldn't even figure out how to get it to work. And then suddenly a pop-up ad comes on and my speakers are set to absolutely booming. And it's Justin Bieber and he's singing through my computer into our otherwise silent office. Everybody was just sort of silent and stared at me. And it just made me feel like, oh my God, I have absolutely no business being here. But it then turned into something even worse because I tried to recover. And so I wanted the team to know that I was there to, you know, to learn. and to do a good job and to ask the right questions. So I had heard this term thrown around all day long on my first day, and I just didn't know what it meant. And I could have Googled it, and I probably should have Googled it. but instead, I decided that I was going to ask my boss, so he knew that I was there for the right reasons. So I turned and I asked, "Hey, Matt, what's a POTUS?" And at that, my new White House colleagues all just sort of groaned or stayed silent. And at that very moment, I learned that dumb questions do exist. And I had just asked one on my first day at the White House. And the truth is, it's kind of a miracle that I wasn't fired after my first day. And the idea that I got to stay for 6 years would have been inconceivable to me, sitting in that room not knowing what POTUS stood for. And it's still kind of crazy to me that it all actually happened.
What was your first role at the White House? And can you give us an insight into what that machine, that operation was like? Because as a journalist, that's what we try and work against each day. What was your first job at the White House?
Sure. So my first job was the most entry-level job you could have in communications at the White House, and it was called Media Monitor. And it was essentially a glorified copy and paster. So I spent my entire days copying and pasting articles from across the internet and sending them to the appropriate people within the White House. So if it was an article on international policy, then it would go to our national security team. Or if it was on healthcare, it would go to our healthcare team. So it was sort of, in some ways, a great job in that it put my name in every consequential member of the administration's inbox every day, so people got to know me. But at the same time, you sort of felt like you were just watching this machine move, and you sort of felt like you weren't fully involved. You were just sort of spectating, copying and pasting constantly. So fortunately, I only did that job for about 8 months, until my boss saw me late one night and told his assistant or his deputy that, hey, Pat looks like death. We should really find him a new job. So I was then promoted about 8 months in.
And that's what I found really interesting, because the position that opened up for you was because the person who had been doing this job before you was in hospital, right? He was working so hard, he made himself physically ill.
So, yeah, that's the thing about the Media Monitor position is my predecessor was actually hospitalized for exhaustion because he was working, 16, 17 hours a day. And then I came in. I was fortunately never hospitalized, but some people might say that's because I wasn't working hard enough. Because the truth is, my successor, her wrist was also undone by excessive copying and pasting to the point where she had to be put in a brace.
That's like extreme control C, control V.
Control C, control V, probably 5,000 times a day, exactly. So I escaped that job relatively unscathed and moved on to other slightly more fun jobs. But it was my way into the White House, and ultimately it was a lot of fun and I learned a lot. But I was very, very happy when my boss, Dan, found me something new.
You graduated from Director of Copy and Paste to the Deputy Director of Messaging. What does that mean?
Messaging for the president is manifold. It is figuring out, first and foremost, how do you use the president's time? Because that's sort of the most valuable thing he has, right? Because he's got so much going on. So we want to figure out how we use that time. And that can manifest itself in interviews or speeches or trips and travel or local events or meeting with quote-unquote real people, folks in America who've sort of dealt with issues that he cares about. So what we tried to do is determine how to use his time and what he would say at different events and what those events would look like. Something he always said to us was, you'll never have a better opportunity to do as much good for as many people as you do right now. So figuring out how exactly to go about that and what to focus on was definitely difficult. Fortunately for us in the communications department, we were kind of just following his lead. And once he said he was focused on this, it was our job to figure out how best to highlight what he wanted to focus on.
Did those 6 years go quickly?
It's funny. In some ways, they went by in a flash. And I think in most ways, they went by in a flash. And in other ways, it felt like sort of a lifetime. It was basically all of my... I walked into the West Wing for the first time when I was 22, and it I never really walked out until I was 29. So I kind of grew up there in a way. So it felt like it went by in a flash, but when I look back on it, it's sort of like, oh my God, I sort of, that's where I spent my 20s. So I can't believe everything that got packed into those six and a half years. But it still sort of feels like I'm on a long sabbatical and eventually I'll go back. So I'm not sure that I've fully gotten over the fact that it's over.
You talk about having to pinch yourself as you sat in your office just down the corridor from the Oval Office. Were there moments right. during that time when you felt totally overawed by the situation?
There were a number of times where I felt personally sort of in awe of the moment. I'll never forget in 2013 when he did his official swearing in the Blue Room to begin his second term, and I was in the room just, you know, by luck because of the job I had at the time. That was a moment where I thought, this is incredible. I couldn't wrap my head around it. And there were other times sort of in the Oval Office where I thought the same thing. But in terms of the challenge, that was something that I'm sure the president and his senior advisors may have felt. But by the time that challenge sort of got down to my level, I felt like there was a handle on things and the president had his arms around it. And we were going to be okay. But the truth is that the one issue that sort of frustrated and flummoxed us the most, I think, was this issue of gun violence in America. And that was something that it was shocking to me that even us sitting in the White House, we couldn't get anybody to act. So that was something that it felt like I was surprised that we couldn't get anything done because of some intransigence in the city and the country. Where you thought maybe, well, this is the White House, we have the bully pulpit, we can make anything happen, and we just couldn't.
And how frustrating was that for the president? Here in Australia, many of us just cannot comprehend these constant acts of violence involving weapons, and we saw the president time and time again plead for change. How frustrating was that for him to not be able to achieve that, as you say, from the biggest pulpit in the world?
Right. Well, yeah, I think he said publicly, you know, that was the single most frustrating thing of his entire presidency. And something that I thought was really telling was you saw him show, you know, President Obama was sometimes mocked for not showing a ton of emotion. Some people called him sort of Spock-like. But in the wake of some of those gun massacres, you saw him crying at the podium in public. Which obviously was a human reaction and completely appropriate. So it's something that he wore fairly openly. I'm still sort of in shock that this is something that continues to happen here. Obviously, we just had another one. And I can't imagine what the president must have thought, you know, being a father and being in a position to do something about it, but not having anyone follow the lead.
What about other big global moments where suddenly the White House finds itself at the center of the story? What were some of the big moments that you remember from your time in the White House?
Sure. Well, I'll never forget a lot of the international travel I did with the president. For instance, Nelson Mandela's funeral, flying down on Air Force One to South Africa, sort of on no notice at all. And, you know, the Bushes were on the plane and Secretary Clinton was on the plane. And this coming together of the global community down in Johannesburg and to be such a, you know, such a small part of that was sort of, I don't quite know the word. It was sort of inspiring to see, you know, the world's leaders all together in this huge stadium honoring this remarkable figure. And for me to be there with someone who I consider to be also a remarkable figure, it was a coming together of so many different things that was, again, sort of hard to wrap my head around. That's what a lot of, I'm not sure if you're gleaning this, but that was a lot of my time at the White House was sort of hard to wrap my head around. And I think it would be for anyone. And that's what I tried to relay in the book, these moments of sort of just insanity and awe mixed in with the everyday things. Of the White House, the sort of minutiae of daily life in the West Wing.
And give us an insight into that daily life. I mean, there must be some funny moments, some lighter moments. We want to hear the gossip. What's some of the White House gossip?
The White House is kind of run by 20-somethings in a lot of ways. So it's a bunch of millennials running the place, and we're all there for, you know, 12, 14, 15 hours a day. So you become like family, and you also start to get on each other's nerves. So it's like any other workplace where, you know, relationships start to form, cliques happen, you get annoyed with people for eating tuna at lunch at their desk. It was like, in some ways, it was like any workplace in the world. And then in some ways, it was unlike any place on Earth. But what was so cool to me was, since I've left the White House, I've gone to, I don't even know how many weddings that were for people who met there while we were there. So this Obama family is sort of, you know, continuing to grow even as he's left office.
You're a bit of a prankster too, from what I hear.
Well, first of all, unfortunately, I was usually the butt of the prank. I don't know if you picked that up from the book. Whenever I tried to pull off a prank, it failed miserably. I remember one, I don't know if you can call it a prank, but I do remember one time the Pope, the new Pope, Pope Francis, was coming to the White House, and everybody was pretty ginned up about it because it was the one time, you know, regardless of if you're religious, it was the one time where the person coming to visit the president was actually more famous than the president himself. And so I sort of, you know, I'm not super religious, but he was the Pope. So I wanted to have an interaction with him. And I remember when the idea hit me, I was sitting at my desk and it felt like just a spark of genius. So I began telling my coworkers and my bosses that I had a plan, that when the Pope walked by, because I thought I knew his route, I was going to walk right past him and fake a sneeze, thereby forcing the Pope to say, God bless you. Now, my coworkers and bosses all thought that this was just a totally ludicrous plan and probably in poor taste, but I thought it was genius. Unfortunately, the day of the Pope's visit, he took a different route, and it was via the South Lawn. So I remember that in the morning I had decided, all right, this is probably wrong. It's probably some sort of a sin. I'm not going to fake a sneeze in front of the Pope. But I went outside to the South Lawn and stood right next to my boss as the Pope came onto the grounds. And I remember it was a sunny September day. And I don't know about you, but when I look up at the sun, sometimes I get this reaction, and I sneezed. And just as the Pope was going by, and my boss is standing right next to me, and it was an utter failure because, number one, the Pope didn't acknowledge me at all. And number two, my boss, of course, thought it was a fake sneeze because I had been, you know, talking this fake sneeze plan up for 2 months. So it was a total disaster. But those were the sorts of, you know, ridiculousness that sometimes happen at the White House. You just never knew who was going to come by, from the Pope to a celebrity to whomever.
Were you involved in any of the visits to the White House by Australian prime ministers?
In my old role as Wrangler, whenever a leader would come and the president would sit in the Oval Office with another foreign leader, we would come in quickly with the press pool and we'd all stand around. So I was in there for those.
So we may have actually met. You may have been one of those very efficient White House staffers pushing me out of the Oval Office during those photo opportunities.
For 2 years, that was my job, and you probably would have recognized our euphemism was, thank you, Poole, and we just would say that over
That's
and
right.
over.
Thank you, Poole. Thank you, Poole.
That was our way of saying, please get out of here now.
You spoke about your first day at the White House. Let's now focus on your last day. What was it like on election night when Barack Obama's presidency effectively came to an end?
That was probably, you know, setting aside some of the tragedies and losses of life and shootings and stuff like that, the election night 2016 was probably the single most sobering night of my life. We had all gathered in my boss, the press secretary's office, which was my desk was sort of connected on his outside wall. And we were all in there and we were partying and we had begun to drink because we were so excited that we were sort of passing the baton to Hillary Clinton, who was going to take it and run with it. And then I'll never forget around, you know, 9:30 or 10 p.m., the tone really started to change and the news started to change. And everybody was drinking suddenly for a very different reason. They were drinking their sorrows away. And I remember leaving the White House around, you know, I forget, midnight or 12:30, and realizing that walking back in was never going to be the same. and going home and then waking up and it was raining. And it was almost like, because now I'm actually now, I'm in, I write for TV. So it felt sort of like a lazy script that I was in where the weather matches the emotions of the moment. But it was raining and the world had seemed to shift overnight. And we got back in to the West Wing that next morning. And I'll never forget, we were all back where we had been partying the night before in Josh Earnest's office when the president's assistant popped her head in and said, the president would like to see all of you right now in the Oval Office. And so we all filtered into the Oval Office, and the president was standing in front of the Resolute desk with Vice President Biden, and he started giving us this pep talk about how hope is called for most in our losses and not our victories, and how history doesn't move in a straight line. It zigs and it zags, and that we would all come back from this, and it wasn't the end of the world. And meanwhile, by the way, I'm standing over in the corner of the Oval Office, and most of my coworkers are sort of poignantly sniffling, and maybe one tear is in the eye. Me, on the other hand, I am ugly crying. It's a completely disgusting mess. So it's totally ridiculous and embarrassing, and my coworkers are like trying to find me tissues desperately. It's just terrible. But then I remember, and this sounds like it's like corny and again, like out of a movie, but I remember the rain had stopped and he looked out into the Rose Garden, which you can see from the Oval Office. And he said, you know, I want to tell America what I just told you guys. And the rain has stopped and I want to tell them outside. I want to do the speech in the Rose Garden because it's more optimistic. And he asked us if we agreed and we all said, yes, we did. And then he gave the same speech to America. And it was just this incredible moment where it was simultaneously the most sobering, sad morning or one of my life. And then also the president there giving us a pep talk. And it really speaks to me to the president's own character. You know, this was his legacy that was on the line and that, you know, was in some ways about to go up in flames. But he took the much longer view than we all did. And that's just sort of the way he was.
So even in the White House on election night, you were completely blindsided by Donald Trump's victory. No one actually saw that coming.
Yeah, I was just completely, completely wrong. I had assumed that she was absolutely going to win. And I, like most of my coworkers, were really taken aback when she didn't.
And what do you make of what the White House and the West Wing has become since you left, when you see what Donald Trump is doing and how he's behaving? How would you characterize his presidency?
In a word, I would characterize it as a disaster. But from the outside, from someone who sat in there for 6 years, it's really kind of sad to me, and it's a little bit hard to watch every day what's going on because, you know, we in the Obama administration certainly were by no means perfect, but we really did adhere to what the president told us, which was what I said before about never having a better opportunity to do more good for more people than we could while we were at the White House. And it just doesn't seem like, for the most part, the president and the folks who are working for him are taking the same stance as Obama was sure to make sure that we were.
And you mentioned earlier, too, that you now write for TV. You work for Designated Survivor, which is a very popular show here in Australia, starring Kiefer Sutherland. Is it better working in a make-believe White House than the real White House?
I would say that it's better working in a make-believe White House than the current real White House.
Very good answer.
I absolutely loved my time on Designated, but working for President Obama was probably will never be topped in my lifetime. But yeah, right now, the Trump White House versus anybody's White House, give me anybody's TV White House.
That's it. After a very busy fortnight of politics in Canberra, have a great weekend.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal Nation, both past and present.
Hear more stories in your language by visiting sbs.com.au.